Hello and welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering Podcast. It's the summer and we've been run ragged, what with one thing and another, so we've a slightly unusual episode for you to enjoy while we take some time to recover. In this podcast, I spoke to Carol Atherton, a teacher and adoptive parent in relation to adoption generally, but also in relation to how adoption is represented in literature as well as media. For many involved in adoption, the media and print portrayals of it can frequently be at best annoying and at worst harmful. So in this episode, we chat around that as well as some other stuff. We hope you find it interesting. And as always, if you've experienced of adoption or fostering or special guardianship from any perspective and would like to share that on the podcast, please do get in touch through the Facebook or Twitter page, or you can email us at andfpodcast@gmail.com.
My name's Carol Atherton. I'm an adoptive parent. I'm an adoptive mum. My son joined our family when he was two. We first met him 2 days after his second birthday, so instantly into the terrible twos. He's now 16, so we've been adoptive parents for 14 years now. And I'm also an English teacher and a writer. I'm really interested in the way that adoption is portrayed in the media and in popular culture and in fiction. And that's, I guess, how I got into, you know, how I found you and how I appeared on the other podcast and so on. So that's why I'm here, really.
Excellent. So I don't know whether you want to share a little bit about your adoption story or, I mean, or should we just get into it? Because I love the idea of books and stuff. I mean, it's up to you. I don't mind. I'm easy.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I guess I've always been aware that in stories, you get lots of characters who are adopted. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've been to the Foundling Museum down in London.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you have, there is a poem on the wall by Lem Sisse, of course, who is care experienced himself. It's called Superman Was a Foundling, and it's basically a list of all these characters in fiction, in books and in films and on television who were adopted or fostered or who were abandoned as children. And there are absolutely loads of them. And because I was a real bookworm when I was growing up, I was always aware of these stories about children who had ended up growing up in families that they weren't biologically related to. I'm wondering, I guess, why so many writers choose to focus on adoption, why so many writers choose to focus on children who are growing up in families that they're not related to. And I guess as I became more aware of adoption and as we began our journey towards adoption, I was thinking about the way that these stories obviously form opinions of what adoption is and what adoption involves. And therefore, for many people, their only experience of adoption comes through popular culture. They don't necessarily know people who are adopted or people who've become adopted parents. And therefore, there's this gap, isn't there, between what the general public often think of adoption and what adoption actually is. And I know, as I've been listening to the podcast over the last few months, so many people, so many of those voices, especially the fantastic people who you've got who have been through adoption, who are adopted adults themselves, talking about this idea of the happy ever after myth of adoption. And one thing I'm really interested in is exploring where these myths of adoption come from, and also how those myths often make life quite difficult and quite complicated for people who are actually involved in adoption themselves.
I mean, to be honest, it's one of the things I find really, really interesting, because the more you get immersed in this world, you see it, you begin to see it more and more everywhere, that it's either a plot device or it's a revelation, or it's a kind of an underlying theme that questions everything, that explains why someone potentially goes a certain way, or like you say, or it just is the, it kind of just plugs into that huge level of sentimentality that, oh, that's
totally.
So where did, I mean, it's a really big question, but do you have any idea where that myth comes from? Why is that there?
Oh, I think there's so much of it in, there's a lot of adoption myths in the Bible. We've got the idea of Moses in the bulrushes, for instance.
Yeah.
I think this idea of having mysterious origins, Freud has this idea of the, you know, the kind of fantasy of adoption, that supposedly every child fantasizes that they have got another family somewhere else, that they have got this potentially different life, this better life, and that apparently is something that helps you in childhood and in adolescence, when there are things that you're not happy with. You know, everybody goes through the phase of thinking, you know, my parents aren't doing this for me, they're not doing that for me. People don't understand me, and that's a terrible thing. So I must have some other family somewhere else. You know, it's that kind of idea, isn't it? That it solves a mystery, it solves a problem.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I'm interested about. I mean, I kind of have read the Bible, and what I find really interesting, because that in some ways it's easy to sort of think, oh well, it's built into that the Christian faith, and the language of adoption is used.
Yeah.
But what I find fascinating is when you look at the stories that are quoted, they bear no resemblance to contemporary adoption. It's just the word adoption.
Not whatsoever.
Fascinating. But that it just taps into this, like you say, there's something in people. And do you think that people, and I always wonder as well, if there's a natural curiosity about this question, can you love someone else's child? It's kind of this eternal.
I think there definitely is. Yeah, absolutely. This sense that, I don't know. I mean, I remember lots of people asking me that when we were applying to adopt. You know, how do you know that you will love this child? How do you know that, you know, that you can make this work? And I guess, I mean, what I always said was that it's a leap of faith. You don't necessarily know, but you know that you want to try, and that's the important thing.
And so do you think that I guess then there's this interplay of the adoption narratives we see. I mean, can you give us a sort of a summary? Can you kind of boil it down to specific tropes within literature?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one really powerful one is the idea that adopted children in fiction are either villains or superheroes. And actually, I remember when my son was about 7 or 8, he was at a friend's house, you know, and he and his friend were playing. And the friend said to him, "Did you know that all adopted children end up in prison?" And my son just didn't bat an eyelid and said, "Well, actually, you're wrong there. All adopted people grow up to be superheroes." And it was this idea that he had the superheroes on his side. And I think, you know, it was great that he had that as a comeback. But I wonder, you know, that must put a huge amount of pressure on you to think that you've got these two archetypes. Which one do you live up to? You know, if you have to be either one or the other. I mean, yeah, if I can talk a bit about some of these adopted characters. I mean, two who I think are fascinating, and this is partly because my husband and my son are both real Star Wars fans, Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia. I mean, if you think about that as an adoption story, one thing that's fascinating about them, I think, is that idea of the backstory. You know, they're these twins. They've got this menacing birth father. They have to be placed at opposite ends of the universe for their own safety. And I remember thinking about this and thinking, imagine being that social worker writing that life storybook. How do you get to grips with all of that? You've got Harry Potter, of course, who's in kinship care, not very good kinship care, admittedly, keeping him under the stairs, but you've got him. Yeah. But then you've also got these damaged characters who, and I guess you were kind of hinting at this earlier, you can almost spot them, can't you? It's like sometimes, you know, on things like Casualty, you can kind of spot the storyline. You've got a small child on a rickety ladder with a chainsaw, and you can see the disaster happening. And sometimes you can see these characters and you think there's somebody who's kind of hanging back, who can't really form relationships with people, who seems as though they've got a bit of a grudge. They've got something that they want to kind of get out of their system.
Yeah.
And you can spot it. You think, yeah, I know what's going to happen. And you can see it. You can see it a mile off. And it is a really easy trope, and quite a lazy trope. that I think is potentially, well, not even potentially, it is really damaging, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there's a couple of things. I went to see the recent release. It's not that recent now. The Joker, the latest version.
Right. Yeah, I haven't seen that.
All right. Well, I can't have this conversation without ruining it without. Well, there's a plot twist at the end that turns out Joker's adopted. Yeah. And he's got a really complicated relationship with his mum. But I went with my son, and he's in his 20s, and he's adopted. And it just felt lazy. It wasn't actually, it was a shorthand way of saying, oh, things aren't right. You know, it was just a really quick way of jumping between A and B or A and Z without going through all of the motions. It just kind of, so people could kind of quite easily just hook into it. But if I can, I'm going to tell you this story because it'll tickle you. A few years ago, this is maybe the dawn of the internet, really. One of the adoption agencies said, "Oh, Luke," you know, trying to build up adoption, was saying, "Oh, Luke Skywalker was adopted. What a great role model." And I thought, it's a terrible role model. You know, the narrative for adoption is that, you know, your birth father tracks you down, maims you. You accidentally sleep with your sister. Your birth father kills your parents. And so you kind of go, this is a really, really bad narrative.
No. It's appalling, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the things that made me first think about this, that first really kind of crystallized my thinking about this, was it must have been a few years after our son was placed with us, because it was when I'd gone back to work and I was teaching The Woman in Black, you know, the Susan Hill novel that was made into a film with Daniel Radcliffe, and it's been a West End play and so on. And it hit me. And it was something that, you know, even though I'd read the novel years before, but at the heart of The Woman in Black is a story of adoption, because The Woman in Black is a birth mother. And she's this incredibly vengeful birth mother, of course. Wow. The story is that it's set in the late 19th century. She became pregnant outside of marriage. Very respectable middle-class family who said that they would disown her if she didn't give her baby to her sister, who was married, and let her sister and brother-in-law adopt the baby. And then, of course, she swears revenge on every happy family she comes across. Because of what happens to her son. So we've got this really kind of intense story. But I was thinking, what would it be like to be a child who was adopted, or a child who was in care, and to be sitting in that classroom, having to study that story, having to read that book, with a class full of people and potentially a teacher who had no idea about their situation and had no idea about the kind of implications of that story, you know, for that child in the room, that child in the class. Because it strikes me that we are quite rightly, you know, not only in education, but in wider society, being so much more conscious of the ways in which different social groups are portrayed and represented. Yeah. But we don't seem to extend that to adoption yet.
Well, do you think that is because people have this, I think you said at the beginning, this happy ever after narrative, that actually adoption is a good thing? Because when you mentioned Harry Potter, I thought, well, I see another trope, which is this idea of children who are in Harry Potter is in an abusive situation. You know, he's kept
absolutely,
but his birth parents are watching over him in a positive way. Mm-hmm. No, this is full of plot spoilers, isn't it? This conversation, we'll have to put a warning at the beginning. They're this benevolent presence constantly around him, guiding him, keeping him safe.
Yeah.
And that could potentially be just as corrosive for a child. I just watched it with my 9-year-old, but she's we're not like that. We talk about things up front, that can be just as unhelpful, can't it?
Absolutely, yeah, because it's this whole idea, isn't it, that if you don't let children know the truth in whatever way is appropriate for them, but if they don't have that understanding, then they can build up this fantasy of what their other life might be like and what it might have been like. Yeah, so this idea, like you say, of a benevolent presence that's always there, but that you can never go back to. You can never, a family can't be there again, can it? Because, of course, in his case, the parents aren't there. The parents are dead.
Yeah, but they're guiding events, and it's quite a, well, it's got the potential if for some children that could be quite an unhelpful narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah,
well, crikey, definitely. We're cheering ourselves up no end, aren't we here?
We are, aren't we? Yeah.
So, are there any books we can read?
Oh, I don't know. There are films that we can watch. I mean, one film that I want to talk about is Secrets and Lies, which is the Mike Lee film.
Oh, yeah.
That was released years ago now, because I remember one of our social workers recommended it to us while we were waiting to get onto our prep course. And of course, that's a really interesting story, isn't it? Because you've got this adopted person, this woman who has just lost her adopted mother. So her adopted parents are both dead, and she decides to trace her birth mother.
Yeah.
And manages to make contact with her. And I think it's really interesting because it disrupts that idea of the happy reunion that we often get. You know, if you think about television programs like Long Lost Family, where everything seems kind of wonderful and it's all hugs and flowers and so on, but you never find out about what happens afterwards, how that relationship might be rebuilt and how that relationship might continue. And of course, in Secrets and Lies, the really complex thing is that the woman who's tracing her birth mother is black, and she doesn't know that her birth mother is white. Similarly, her birth mother knew that she had this baby that she placed for adoption, knew that she'd had a number of relationships with men, any one of whom could have been the father, but doesn't actually know that this baby was black. And what I find really interesting about that film is that the two actors playing those two characters didn't know about this until they actually filmed the reunion scene. So the sense of shock for them was absolutely genuine.
It was palpable. Yeah,
absolutely. And you get this really awkward meeting, this very long sequence between the two of them sitting in this cafe, trying to work out what on earth has happened and what on earth they're going to do with this knowledge. And I think that film makes a really good job of showing that reunion is difficult and it does need to be worked at, and it's not necessarily the kind of magical experience that often we are told it is. You know, that's the narrative that's often sold, isn't it? That people get back together and they find that they've got all these magical connections, you know, and it's not necessarily the case.
No, and I think it's important, isn't it? Because again, the happy ever after, that's like the extra happy ever after, isn't it? That all of these three parties come together. And that's just not possible. Even reflecting on my own children's experiences, that even if they can meet and have a positive relationship, it's not ever going to be that relationship. It's never going to be what it was originally or what it should have been. It's something else. And it's very rare to see that slightly awkward, slightly not. Yeah. So that, like you said, it's a while since I've seen that film, but I probably should go back and revisit. I think I will do that. But what about there's more contemporary. I've not watched it, but is it the recent, is it Apple TV? We're not sponsored. Matched, is it? Is that the program?
Oh, I've not seen that, but that sounds interesting. What's that? Is that about the whole adoption process?
It is, yeah. It's a really contemporary sort of comedy drama, I believe. And it's, uh-huh. I think the word on the street is that it's quite good and it reflects contemporary experience. But I think it's, again, very much through the lens of adopters, not adopted people.
Yeah.
Which, again, is that reflected in the sort of literature and media? Is there one lens that's elevated above other lenses, or one perspective? Ooh,
that's a really difficult one. Thinking about the adoptive parents that I've looked at In fiction and on film and on television, you often get this sense of adoptive parents being portrayed as a bit clueless. This sense that they are going into this process with all these ideals, but they don't really know what they're doing. They're quite naive. One brilliant example that I found, quite an obscure example, is there's a Korean Danish artist called Jane Jin Kaysen, and she's really interesting. She's a visual artist and a photographer and a documentary maker. Now, she was born in Korea, adopted by a Danish family, and she writes and creates art about this idea of dislocation, transnational adoption. And she turns the whole idea on its head. And in her book is called Loving Belinda. And she has this Danish girl, Belinda, who's adopted by a Korean couple. And because she turns the kind of cultural axis, you know, completely in the opposite direction, it's really interesting that she kind of exposes the naivety of the adoptive parents. Because there's one bit of it where they're talking about how they try to keep her Danish culture alive and how they try to keep her, you know, in touch with her roots. And they do this by buying her lots of Lego and making sure they've got IKEA furniture. And somebody points out that IKEA is Swedish, not Danish. And they say, well, you know, it's still Scandinavian. That's okay, isn't it?
They're all white.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there's a real sense of kind of naivety and wanting to do the right thing. But skating over the difficulties and sometimes pretending that all those complicated bits that we know are always going to be there with adoption, trying to pretend that they're not there. And you often get these incredibly, you know, naive couples who are very well-meaning, but end up doing the wrong thing. Or alternatively, you get adoptive parents who are completely the opposite and who are very, very cold and not loving at all. And there's a sense that almost as though the narrative is saying that these people were never meant to be parents anyway, in a weird way, that they, you know, they don't have the child at the center of their relationship at all. There's a number of stories that I've read where the adoptive parents constantly remind the child that they are adopted. You know, that this child isn't allowed to say, I'm your son. They've always got to say, I'm their adopted son. So they're always reminded of that status as if it's a kind of subordinate status. So that's really interesting as well, that, you know, when adoptive parents are portrayed, you know, you get that sense of idealism and naivety, but you don't really get any stories engaging with the complexity of adoptive parenting. And I wonder whether that's a kind of conscious thing as well, you know, that sense. And it's, you know, it's something that I know you've talked about on the podcast, that sense that the difficulties are something that people often like to draw a veil over.
Because the murky stuff.
Yeah, the murky stuff, the difficult stuff.
That is really interesting, isn't it? Because I guess any sort of form of medium, drama, book, film, play, whatever. Well, by definition, it's not real life, is it? It's got it's got to emphasize a point, or it's making a point. So there's an element of caricatures and people being caricatures. But I mean, do you think that because we're so involved and you know, as adult adopters, we're very involved, that we will never find anything that's going to scratch our itch. It's either going to be, you know, too much or too little.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there, in the same sense that, you know, whenever I see anything on television that deals with teaching, you know, you always spot the bits that aren't right. And I guess you know, you must be the same. You can spot the bits that have been glossed over, or where something's been you just think it wouldn't be like that in reality. But I guess, I mean, I'm thinking about, I mean, there was that drama series that was on the BBC a few years ago, The A Word, about parents whose little boy had autism. And I remember, you know, there being a sense that that really was drawing attention to the difficulties, the challenges of parenting a little boy. I think he was about 6 years old at the time, who was diagnosed with autism, and coming to terms with that, and coming to terms with that, what that would mean for his future and his relationships, you know, and their relationships with the wider family, helping them to understand his autism and the kind of adjustments that they would need to make. And I wonder whether, you know, there might be scope for something exploring, not necessarily the kind of every single bit of the difficulties of adoption, but giving more of a sense, giving more of a realistic sense of what the whole thing involves.
Because I think that the media is a, in some ways, it's an opportunity for the right person with the right screenplay to make, to kind of make a quantum shift or in culture. Because yeah. I reflect back on, I don't know whether you're familiar with the Kathy Come Home in the 60s, which was the, it Mike Lee or Ken Loach? It was one of the two.
That was Ken Loach.
It was Ken Loach, and sort of a seminal play for today that just altered perceptions about homelessness and housing and poverty and parent, you know, and that, you think that you, that if there was someone who could catch it at the right moment, it could just flip the whole idea around, you know, the narratives of forced adoption and the complexity of child protection and
absolutely
the murkiness. Do you think that's a possibility, or am I just living in sort of pipe dream?
I don't know. I think that would be intriguing, wouldn't it? I don't know who could do it, but there must be somebody out there. You know, who could bring that story to life. I think it is something that needs doing. I mean, thinking about, because we've all been through it, I guess, as adoptive parents, the things that other people say about adoption and how often they are, you can see the traces of what adoption was like 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
There's still this assumption that adopted children are going to be newborn babies, or, you know, babies no more than, you know, 3 or 4 months old, that they will have been given up for adoption. That idea that they're relinquished voluntarily. And I remember when I was just about to go on adoption leave, one of my colleagues said to me, well, what will you do if his real mum decides she wants him back? And I remember thinking, I don't quite know where to start unpicking that and explaining that. That just doesn't happen, and that it can't happen.
It reflects a different time and a different paradigm.
Totally, but that, different time.
But that is such a strong, it's got such a strong grip on people's psyche. Like you, I remember when my first 3 children came, and they were lovely children, beautiful children, and we introduced them to friends. I remember one of my friends just tearing up and saying, why would anyone, I can't understand, why would anyone give these children away? And I said, it was just really, and he said, do you still believe that's that's not this story? This is a different time. And
yes.
But that isn't the story people want to hear, is it?
No, it's not.
That's not the romantic story.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Because of course, we then get the other story, and you kind of alluded to it a couple of minutes ago, this forced adoption narrative, this idea of social workers snatching babies. And that, I guess, is another narrative that people sometimes like to believe, or it's an easy narrative to believe, isn't it?
Well, yeah, there's that sense of injustice. That's an attractive story, isn't it? Because there's a conclusion where, you know, child, mother, or parents reunite, and because of the wrongdoing of whoever, you know, the social workers, you know, I guess even the story set historically, people just sort of, they're universal tropes, aren't they? You know, evil social worker, or evil school mum, or evil police officer, or whatever.
Yes.
Which is a bit all of a twist.
It is, very much so. Yeah.
And also Annie is, you know, Mrs. Hannigan.
Yeah.
The first day my children moved in, they all sat and watched Annie, and they said, we want to watch it. And I said, you can't. Ooh. And I mean, they'd been watching it for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
Over and over. And I said to my wife, I said, please tell me why we can't do this. I need to know. And she went, if they want to watch it, let them watch it. and they watched it. And I just thought, this is so wrong. This is so wrong. Oh. They loved it, bless them. But that narrative is bad people at work, nefarious plots, but it's all okay in the end, isn't it? Because Daddy Warbucks sorts it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody will sort it out and everything will be happy ever after. Yeah.
Oh, crikey.
Yeah.
I don't know where to go with all this because I feel like there's so many stories, and the more you look, the more you see them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, one adoption story that I was very familiar with as a child was Anne of Green Gables, which is one of these real classics from the 19th century. And I don't know if you know the story. It's set in Canada. The writer's Canadian. And there's a brother and sister who boy to help on the farm. So they send a message to the local orphanage, as people could do back at that time, that they want to adopt a boy to help them on the farm. Because, of course, why else would you adopt a child? And when this child actually arrives, when the brother Matthew turns up at the station to collect this child, the orphanage has sent a girl instead.
Oops.
And the neighbours all think this is terrible and it's a scandal and they should just send her back. And one of the neighbours, this real neighbourhood busybody, says, well, adopting children's a bad idea anyway, because I've heard of adopted children who will put poison down the well and will roast you in your beds at night. That sense of adopted children having to overcome all of those, you know, all of those bizarre kind of images that they're bombarded with.
Yeah, I mean, even right up to contemporary stuff, which, you know, that was Loki, you know, the whole, the Avengers.
Yeah.
Loki's adopted. Loki's fundamentally, he's a mischievous, he's kind of a cult hero, isn't he? But he was adopted by by Odin. Let me get my mythology right. and it's constantly, you know, you were loved and I wasn't loved. It's kind of at the quiet moments, but it's kind of an acceptable way of hanging a character that's problematic, of saying, oh, well, that's probably it then, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, crikey.
Yeah, that's the explanation. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is really interesting, isn't it? And I'm just kind of having to think about some of those issues, I guess. I mean, another one, we get all of those ideas, don't we, about adoption and it being an easy solution, almost this kind of mathematical idea. You know, couple can't have children, child needs a home, and therefore adoption's the easy way of sorting it all out. Mm. And how often then that plays into arguments about things like NHS funding for fertility treatment. And you get people saying, well, you know, why do they need to go through that anyway? Because they could always just adopt. And that just adopt phrase that, you know, I'm sure so many of us have heard at different times, as if it's that easy.
Yeah, and it commodifies children, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it?
Which is really unhelpful. And I think that's one of the things I struggle with a lot of the universal question, isn't there? Children for families or families for children.
Yeah.
And those narratives often don't address any of that. Or they do in a way that it's just really unhelpful. Oh, crikey. But anyway, tell me, you're writing a book. I'm going to move us on before we get stuck in the mire of how bleak it all is. You're writing a book.
I am.
Excellent. Tell us about that then.
Yes, my book is called, well, provisionally called, Someone Else's Child. And what I do in the book is to trace our adoption story. And I am focusing very much on me, my husband, going through the whole process from when we decided to adopt to when our son was first placed with us. Because, of course, anything else is his story, and that's not my story to tell. But what I'm doing is setting that story alongside I guess, the history of adoption and how it's changed over the course of the 20th century, early 21st century, but also setting it alongside some of these myths and some of these great stories about adoption to show how they shaped our thinking about adoption as we were going through the whole process, and how the reality of adoption, of course, differs from all of those stories and from those myths. And I found some really fascinating things. Lots and lots of newspaper adverts from the early 20th century advertising children for adoption, which was appalling. You know, it's one of those sort of things where you think, really, that actually happened? It kind of brings you up short. Some really interesting documentaries kind of from the 1970s, kind of old episodes of World in Action, talking about children who are in the care system, and the shortage of adoptive parents, the shortage of prospective adopters. So it's been a really interesting experience writing it. And I have an agent, and we are currently on the lookout for a publisher. So if anybody is interested in publishing my book, then get in touch.
I'm sure there's lots of publishers to listen. I'm not sure. We'll put the word out. I think that's really interesting. That's the sort of book that I would find fascinating. So you'll have to let us review it. Because I think that anyone coming to adoption has to be switched on to this stuff. I think that the days of, the preparation, you have to understand because I think that we need to understand where adoption is going. Because I think I had a conversation with someone quite recently who sort of came to me out of the blue and said, I'm thinking of adoption. What do you think? And they got I just gave them about 45 minutes of just how complicated it is. And knowing the individual, and they work for an NGO, and they're kind of quite, they're in that sort of world of ethics and governmental stuff. I said, you have to question, will you be on the wrong side of history in 20 years' time?
Yeah.
So that's the sort of book I would find fascinating, because I think we need to, what is the trajectory in 30 or 40 or 50 years' time when we'll still be parents and hopefully still alive?
Yeah.
What will society be saying, and what will the government be saying, and what will adopted adults be saying, and birth families? So it'd be interesting to chart up to now, because it'll probably point towards where we're going, won't it?
Yeah. That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I guess there's also the fact that we might be on the wrong side of history, but we will have done the best job we can for our children, within our individual families.
We may try
as hard as we can for them, to help them through, to help them make sense of whatever it is that they've been through.
And maybe we'll have helped altered history as well, to get history. We're part of that history, aren't we?
Definitely.
And it's easy. I mean, it's easy to look back, isn't it, and be appalled by historic practice. But it was probably seen as really progressive, and it got us, what was the option before that? What was the option before
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely, there wasn't. There really wasn't.
So even like now, I recently, we were just talking through some papers, and I found a copy of the Be My Parent magazine, they all print. And just, there was none of our children in it. I don't think our children wouldn't be my parent. But reading through it, and you go, it was only 5 or 6 years old. But crikey, this feels like history.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, now that things have moved on, and now that we've got Linkmaker and so on. But I remember, I remember there being discussions about, adoption activity days. When we were going through the whole process, and people saying, well, is that the right thing to do? Should children be put in that kind of environment, and to know that these people who are, these adults who are there being introduced to them, are on the lookout for children who might become their children? It's one of those weird things, isn't it?
Yeah, which is, you've sort of reflected on the adverts in newspapers. It's the evolution of what was probably really progressive, and people were going, well, it's edgy, but it's working. We're getting kids into homes.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
But in 100 years' time, will two people be on a podcast or whatever the version is saying? And do you know what they used to do? They used to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
It's, Yeah. But I think that sounds interesting. That book that that you describe your book, and it'd be interesting to see, because it points forwards, doesn't it?
It just, yes. Yeah.
That's really interesting.
I think so. Yeah, because it's saying this is a process that's a whole lot more complicated than people often think it is. And, thinking about, just going through that whole process for my husband and I, the process that we went through from, making that initial decision, going through things like the prep course, and, people saying, well, why is it right that social workers put you through all of that? Why is it right that they can ask you so many intrusive questions and put you through all that stress? And thinking, well, actually they have to, and people need to understand that they have to, because I liken it to a kind of multi-stage interview process for the most complicated but the most important job you will ever have. And that, they have to make it difficult. They have to make it stressful, because if you go through with this, if you become an adoptive parent, then you need to know what that will involve and how that will test you and how important it is that you understand the trauma, the loss that your child has been through, not just when the child is placed with you and in the future, but all the way through into that child's adulthood. That you need to face up to that, and you need to acknowledge that, and it's right that the process is so complicated and that it's so testing.
I mean, absolutely, yeah. And I look back even to the 80s, and you see that people just needed a good letter of recommendation and a brief interview. I knew a couple who got a good letter off their priest saying, they're upstanding citizens, come to church on Sundays, and jobs are good. And their story is their daughter, they struggled, their daughter struggled with addiction in young adulthood and found themselves in, put through the ringer, police, all of that world. And that interview process didn't cut the mustard, really. I mean, it turns out for them, they were incredibly resilient and.
Yeah.
But just, it doesn't really bear. I can't countenance it being hard enough myself. I think, make it as,
absolutely.
We grease the stairs, hard to get in, easy to get out. Crikey. Well, Carol, it's been a fascinating conversation, and I feel like we should start a movie club, shouldn't we? You should do an online movie club. That's what you should do.
Adoption book club.
Yeah, the adoption book club, because that would be fascinating, wouldn't it? I could do a movie club because Anne of Green Gables doesn't sound like I'm like a typical man book reader. Yeah. I read about the history of the Boer War, that's what I do.
Right.
But I enjoy films. So thank you so much for coming on, and I really appreciate you giving your time. And certainly, as and when your book comes out, we will kind of be more than happy to put links to it and push it and all of those kind of things. Cool. Okay.
Thank you for having me.
No reason.
Thank you.
Bye. So actually, we just stopped, and then Carol remembered a book that she wanted to tell us about. So Carol, go for it.
Yeah, it's a book that was published early last year, a book aimed at sort of older children, younger teenagers, called The Unadoptables. And it's set in Amsterdam in the 19th century. It's set in this orphanage, focuses on five children who were all considered unadoptable because they had something supposedly wrong with them. So one of them's got 12 fingers. One of them's got ears that stick out. One of them is a girl who's a bit feisty. And obviously nobody would want to adopt a girl who's a bit feisty and can stand up for herself.
I'm saying nothing as the father of five daughters.
Absolutely. And just the idea that, in 2020, that a publishing company would publish a book called The Unadoptables, that would be bought by parents and bought by schools and put in school libraries. And just this idea that could happen in this day and age.
Oh, so it's not a book that's got a positive message. Would you say it's got a positive message? All right.
Not particularly. No. It's, I guess it's this idea that these children who are in this orphanage and the adventures that they have, and how they scandalize everybody by not being adoptable and how they're treated as being these terrible children who nobody will ever want. And I remember at the time there was a bit of a storm about it. Lots of people saying that this is really offensive. And if it had been written, if the kind of equivalent portrayal had been produced about any other particular social group, there would have been an absolute outcry. But somehow adoption is just treated as a kind of a bit of a plot trope, like we said, rather than something that affects real people and real lives.
Oh, crikey. Well, that's one to avoid, isn't it?
Yeah.
Blimey. Well, there you go. I'll press stop again.